So good morning. My name is Annette Morgan, and it's actually an honour to actually have been speaking after Walter's address, because I've, as I did say, spent a long time getting to know Walter, and he did help me get tax clinics up and going, and he introduced me to many, many people at the tax office who probably wish Walter didn't do that. I've a little bit of a headache, I think, at times to them with the tax clinics. But today we're honoured to have our session in regards to disputes and how to handle vulnerability. And with me today, we have Rob Thompson from the ATO. Many of you will know Rob from his TV appearances. And Ruth Owens, of course, our tax ombudsman. So just a couple of housekeeping rules as we go through, being the first session or second session, is make sure we just have our mobile phones off. There will be morning tea after this session, but we'll be hearing from one of the sponsors before we head out to that. So please don't run away when we are finished. First off, I want to talk about the decision making and what vulnerability is, and I want to ask that question to our panelists as well. Being from, you know, one of the biggest tax clinics, being Curtin University, we deal with a lot of vulnerability and compliance work for a lot of people who can't handle the responsibilities for themselves. And just to set the scene of discussions of what we're talking about today, I want to just raise a case that came my way earlier this week through the tax clinic. And a lot of these taxpayers are supported by support workers, other professionals, other organizations who, you know, need to reach out to professionals to provide assistance. We had a mother whose son committed suicide up on the mines a couple of years ago. And this mother is just unable to get on with her life effectively and needs a support worker to help her. But what one of the things she's been doing to help her is writing a book in regards to mental health, especially in regards to young men up on FIFO sites. And she really wants to get that going, and she's created an organization and a charity. And what got me first is somebody offered to help her, took her money, and then just left her with nothing. So she's got this idea, this concept, she's got nowhere to go, she doesn't have any money, and she's got a lot of people in the mind saying, if you can get that going, we will get you to come up and talk about this to our young men. So we spent the time with her earlier this week, the tax clinic, she's also got outstanding tax returns herself from a small business. In the week her son died, she lost her son, her business was shut down, and she was put on the street, basically. So these are the types of people that clinics are seeing that need the help. But we don't see them all like that. We see other clients who just need a little bit of a helping hand occasionally, get back on their feet, and then can engage with the system. So I just wanted to highlight a little bit about what clinics are. If you don't know about them, you can, of course, Google the National Tax Clinic System, and there's 20 of us around the place doing all of this amazing work. And we're very pleased also to have been part of inputting into the framework for vulnerability and giving our insights to the tax office and also to the tax ombudsman of what we're actually seeing in this space. We also see a lot of work in regards to economic and financial abuse and domestic abuse, which also uses the tax system as a weapon, okay? But I'd like to sort of set the scene today by asking both of my panelists, you know, how would you describe the vulnerability within the tax environment? You know, what does it look like? Who's affected by it? And sort of what of each of your organizations are you seeing at the moment being discussed by taxpayers or their professional advisors in regards to vulnerability? So I might start with you first, Rob.
Thanks, Annette. And thanks to the Tax Institute for having us here. It's good to be in Perth as an ex-Perth boy. So it's great to be home. I think when the ATO thinks about vulnerability and in the context of our role in the system, we think about people experiencing vulnerability as someone that is at an increased risk of harm, exploitation, exclusion, or isolation. And that can be caused by a range of factors. And it's those factors that cause the vulnerability as opposed to making any assessment on the person themselves. And that can be things such as social, environmental, physical factors, a lack of essential services, through to things like mistreatment and abuse. And there's an acknowledgement that anyone can actually experience vulnerability at some point in their life. That can be temporal, it can be long-term, or it can be permanent. We see that in the context of the ATO is that that can impact their ability to meet their tax obligations and create additional barriers for them to be able to engage, pay, register or lodge. And so from an ATO perspective, thinking about our role in the system, we're not best placed within the ecosystem to provide social work or counselling services to these people. But our role is to think about how we can support them with their tax obligations, working with partners, including the tax profession, to help them to get to meet their tax obligations or reduce the barriers that might be creating an issue for them to be able to meet their tax obligations. And we think about that in the context of the individual themselves. So that can be in their capacity as an individual taxpayer, but it also can be, small businesses have an individual behind them, trustees of SMSFs, so very much this just doesn't relate to an individual and their own personal income tax. So, that's how we think about vulnerability in our role, and an acknowledgement, though, that we also need to think about how we have appropriate referral pathways. So it's where it's not within the remit of the tax office, how do we make sure those people are getting the support they can get that they may need? Where they're not getting it, acknowledging that kind of the privacy restrictions about us sharing information.
All right, thank you. Good morning, everybody. Again, thank you to the Tax Institute for inviting me today to talk about this really important topic. So very much build on what Rob's just said. Don't disagree at all with everything that Rob said. I actually come to tax from a social policy background, so I've looked at vulnerability through different lenses, I suppose. So we all know there is no sort of strict definition of vulnerability, but I think of vulnerability about people who are in either permanent situations or temporary situations where they are kind of susceptible to risk or harm and probably just don't have that resilience or capacity to be able to help themselves in that moment and need some form of kind of support or protection, either permanently or temporarily. What I see, putting my tax hat back on, what I see in the tax system are obviously people struggling with their finances. That can be for a huge variety of reasons that you'll be very familiar with. And it might just take one life event, one unfortunate incident, for things to just topple over quite quickly. So I think I would say, in terms of who experiences vulnerability, pretty much all of us experience vulnerability at some stage in our lives. I know I can think about when I was bereaved. I was in a position where I wasn't thinking about my finances. I expect as I get older, I might experience periods of vulnerability. So I think, if you're thinking this isn't about you or people you know, well, it probably is. It may well be, and probably likely to be. And it definitely is people who are going to be in your client group. It may be invisible to you in terms of your understanding of their situation, because you'll just have one lens on their financial business. But no doubt there'll be vulnerability in there, and that could be visible. It may be some form of permanent disability when, again, it's easier to diagnose, it's easier to reach out and help people when you understand what they're capable or not capable of. Mental health issues, I'm sure you will see in your practice. I know the profession take mental health issues really seriously now, which is good, because obviously having stress and financial distress can really either cause or exacerbate mental health issues. Or you might see people who've actually experienced trauma throughout their lives, or historical trauma, and really understanding how to treat them differently to be able to support them. We'll talk later, no doubt, but like the tax clinics, my office deals a lot with people who experience financial abuse. So that's a particular watch out, I think, for those of us in the tax sector, that not only do you deal with people who've experienced vulnerability or are experiencing vulnerability, but sometimes the tax system creates vulnerability by being weaponized against people in those difficult situations. So that's just a watch out for all of us. With my ombudsman hat on, as you all know, I have two functions. One is to take complaints, the other is to undertake systemic reviews. So a number of my systemic reviews try to make sure that I've got a lens on vulnerability. The review I did on financial abuse within the tax system is the most obvious example of that. But even just the report I published last week on general interest charge remission was looking at for those taxpayers in particular who just maybe just slipped between the cracks of the system, maybe just had one bad luck after another, and looking for the ATO to find some degree of discretion or flexibility in their response. And then in my complaints, again, I don't see all the things that go right in the tax office. I only see people who are really struggling who want to come to me to raise complaints. So the vast majority of the complaints that reach my office probably do display some form of vulnerability. And again, like the tax office, my office has a responsibility to make sure that we can tailor our services to make sure we can meet people where they are and recognise their vulnerability and serve them accordingly.
Thank you. So that leads us on to, like, we've seen an increase in this concept and discussion of vulnerability and forms of abuse, especially with the government also releasing some asking for submissions from Treasury late last year about vulnerability and the abuse of the weaponization of the tax system and other forms. So how has the role of vulnerability evolved into the tax environment over recent years, and why is it such now a critical consideration for us all to be aware of? So, you know, what do you think is driving this shift? Because we didn't talk about this probably, you know, 3 years ago, yet it's become a very big focus of government, ATO, Roof doing a review into it. We've had this big shift. What do you think has been driving that? Oh, either one of you can go first.
I'm happy to go first. I think that's probably a big environmental social question as to what's driving it. I think, you know, from the ATO's perspective, we have been seeing more people present with experiences that are creating that are putting them into a situation where they're experiencing vulnerability. A number of partners we've spoken to in the system, specifically those that work more in the social work sector, have said to us they've seen an increase post-COVID. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we are seeing more people present. And, you know, I think we're also, the ATO is also supporting the government priorities and initiatives that have been announced from a whole of government perspective. So you know, there's that. I think the vulnerability work also kind of aligns with our new vision and purpose that Anna spoke about earlier, about ensuring that we are offering tailored support and making it easy for people to comply, noting that there's a section of the community out there where there's additional barriers for them to be able to get to compliance. But we've actually had, I mean, we have a dispute assist program, which if we're talking about it purely in a disputes context, and we've actually had that for over 10 years. Mm. So I think about 10, 12 years ago, we recognised that people that were coming to the disputes and objections with no representation, you know, and were experiencing vulnerability, probably were facing more significant barriers to being able to engage in those dispute processes, which are an important part of the tax system, and them being able to exercise their rights. And so we did develop a dispute assist program about 10 years ago, and that was just an acknowledgement that disputes are just not technical matters, but they can kind of be shaped by a person's circumstances, and all of those circumstances are outside their control. So we have had, I think, a number of specific programs across the office and initiatives across the office to help people experiencing vulnerability. I think the vulnerability capability and the vulnerability framework is just about how we increase that level of coordination and support across the ATO, and making clear to both our partners, the community, and also our staff around what our principles are for supporting people experiencing vulnerability.
Yeah, I think it's always been there, hasn't it? You know, the tax system has always had a degree of discretion to address the fact that you have to deal with every Australian, and that does mean that some people will need different sets of circumstances and different responses. But I think if I were going to be a little bit challenging in this room, I would say that the tax system, not just the ATO, but the tax system overall, is in a little bit of a catch-up mode. A lot of organisations have been on this journey long before 2026, and the tax system is just kind of catching up with what other organisations have done. You can talk to anyone in financial services, banking industry. They've been doing this since their Royal Commission, which is, what, a good 5 years ago, I guess. They've all got vulnerability frameworks. They've all worked out how to address people in financial distress. So I guess if I were in banking, I'd say you sometimes need something like a Royal Commission to make you wake up and do something different and have that kind of mirror held up to you. I can also recall when I was a commissioner in the UK tax system, I established a service, what we called extra support services. That would have been back in 2012. So I do think it's great we are where we are now, and it's great that we're doing this work, but it probably is a little bit later than other organisations. But I think, you know, I think the difficulty of having conversations about vulnerability, about expressing need for support, about expressing really difficult traumatic circumstances like domestic violence, you know, it's a community thing. The community has to be ready to have those conversations, to be able to share those things. And I think perhaps just through a culmination of where community is post-COVID, what we've seen other organisations do already has brought us to this point where it absolutely feels like the right time to make sure the tax system is ready to respond in the same way.
That's great. So what are some of the most common misunderstandings that impact practitioners have about vulnerability when dealing and managing with their clients' affairs? So you just mentioned there about the banks and stuff like that, and you know, electricity companies and gas companies who have a lot more flexibility in what they're able to do because they're not really regulated by the government. And from a taxpayer point of view, you know, if the bank decided to write somebody's mortgage off under the circumstances, you know, that's their shareholders who deal with that problem. But if, you know, unfortunately the tax office, you know, an administrator under laws for the government, so don't have the ability in a lot of cases to write a lot of debt off, you have to go to the finance minister. But also as a taxpayer, we wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't appreciate if everybody's debt got written off because there go services. So we have to acknowledge that the tax office is not like the banks and the electricity companies who can just go and do that, and they affect a small proportion of shareholders. The tax office has a much bigger pool of people to look after and are administered and just go by whatever the politicians' laws are at the time. So what I, leading on to that, so that is, I think, one of the misconceptions that I have a lot of times with people, other, especially with other partners in the system, about why the tax office just can't do that. And so we'll lead into that question about, you know, what are some of the other misunderstandings that you feel practitioners or partners have in that space? Rob?
I think you've probably touched on the main one in there.
Okay.
I've probably got two. The first one is kind of that, which unpacks that kind of question around, and I don't think it's so much tax practitioners, I think it's others, other partners, and their views around what they think the Commissioner can and cannot do and what we can actually do within the legislation, and that can cause some frustration both for the ATO, but I think when they go to engage with the tax agent says, no, you can't. That's not going to be possible. So there's that element. And I think the second bit is like just an understanding that your clients aren't always going to disclose their circumstances to you because of either shame or because they don't think it's relevant or because they're actually concerned for their safety. You know, we've heard more in the intimate partner financial abuse section that, you know, like, this view that you either take the money or the violence, but you don't get both, which is really harsh. But, you know, like, so if someone's concerned about their children, they're concerned about their family, and, you know, the implications there, then they don't see the debt or the tax issue as being their largest concern. So just, I think, that second one, a recognition they might not always disclose what's going on. Which is why it's, I think, an imperative on all of us to make sure that we think about what are those cues or those indicators. But probably back to the first one, I think, you know, the banks is a good example where they have more discretion. You know, I think the Commissioner's been quite clear in talking about vulnerability that, you know, it's not ATO money. It's, you know, it's government's money, it's community's money. It goes towards a number of essential services, and therefore there is some discretion given to the Commissioner, but actually those discretions around things like debt relief, and also DPN defences are quite legislatively constrained, and there's policy reasons around those, and so, but compared to some of the ability for some of the other organisations or institutions that these people may also have debts with, and their ability to waive debts or be more flexible, does create, I think, some friction and some misunderstanding. And so we know there's more for us to do about being clear about what we can and cannot do, and making clear in our guidance, and that's one of Ruth's recommendations, about making sure that we're making that clear to tax agents, to partners, to the community, and website guidance. So we are working on that, being clear about what we can do, but then being clear where we do have discretions, about how we'll apply those discretions and the kind of evidence or information we will ask for in considering those cases.
Yeah, if I just build on that, because I think, yeah, we all recognise ATO's hands are tied by legislation and the discretions. So I see a variety of sort of misconceptions about that. And my advice to everybody in the room is be really clear about what those discretionary powers are, because if you put your case as a sort of, you know, here's a sad, tragic case of somebody in really difficult circumstances, unfortunately that doesn't necessarily meet the discretionary powers that the Commissioner's got. But if you are able to articulate it alongside the powers and the legislation or under the PSLA guidance that's published, you're far more likely to be able to filter that your case through to the right person so that's got the discretion, and you're helping them make that decision by saying that this arm of this legislation, I can see the criteria, meets my particular client's circumstances. So I think you can help yourselves and help your clients by being really clear under what criteria you are describing a particular vulnerability. I would also say, I'm sure nobody in this room, but sometimes you do hear people say, well, sort of everybody who's in debt is experiencing vulnerability. And of course, that's not true either. There are people who are in debt not experiencing vulnerability. So it is the tricky job of all of us as sort of stewards of the system and taxpayers that we want the right approach for the right set of criteria and conditions, that those who are experiencing vulnerability do get a kind of different pathway, but that doesn't necessarily mean everybody does. And then my final misconception, I suppose, is when we talk about the vulnerability framework and concessions, I do hear some practitioners sort of say, oh, once you put that in place, everybody's going to sort of, you know, open the door and everyone will rush through. And again, the experience of the banks and people like that is when they established vulnerability frameworks, it hasn't been exploited. You know, the right people have found their way to the right source of help through the right criteria. It isn't a kind of open gate that everybody is likely to seek to exploit. So let's remember that and go to the taxpayer charter of assuming most people are going to do the right thing.
Can I just build on one of Ruth's points? When Ruth talks about ensuring the bit around understanding, you know, how that person's experience may apply to our guidance, that's probably another misconception we do see is actually that because someone has experienced something that's fairly traumatic in their life at some point, that means that the concession or the discretion may apply. And I think one of the takeaways is for tax practitioners is if you do have clients in that circumstance, is being able to work with your client to explain to the tax office how that's actually impacted their tax obligations, because, you know, we kind of to Ruth's point, we do need to make the connection between that vulnerability, that experience creating a barrier, as opposed to them just having some unfortunate, you know, circumstances in their life. So I think that's one thing as well, if you do have clients in this that are experiencing vulnerabilities, is helping to explain that to the tax office, noting that people experiencing vulnerability, you know, will be going through, if they're still going through it, will be going through trauma, which means how they explain things and their memory is not always, you know, there. And so I think that's an important way that you can assist your clients in engaging with the tax office.
So that sort of leads me on to a question I was going to raise with you, Rob, is how should practitioners raise vulnerability with the ATO and in a way that is constructive, evidence-based and effective for their clients? I think you led into that, so we would go to that question.
Yeah, so I think Anna kind of talked about this early, but I think just engaging early, so the earlier we can, it's disclosed to us, you know, the ATO has a lot more discretion, both in across all its administration, but in an objection and litigation sense, where we have more discretion to take administrative actions like pause the action, to give you time, adjourn court dates, you know, give you more time for you to work with your client to provide the evidence that the commissioner may need, as opposed to when the debt or the liability is actually crystallised. So the earlier that you're able to have that conversation with the ATO and the ATO to know that, we can think about that in terms of appropriate support, but also then what's appropriate in terms of our discretions. We are currently doing some work around our position on a policy, which isn't, I think, inconsistent with what we do a lot of the time anyway, but we're just documenting it, about how we might think about evidence in the context of people experiencing vulnerability. So working through both updates to our practice statements, but also thinking from a policy, from an ATO perspective, around when we might be okay with, in what circumstances we need to probably ask for a little bit more evidence, as opposed to when we may not. And some of the factors associated with that is kind of a risk-based decision around the risk associated with that decision, so both from a quantum perspective but also a system integrity perspective, but also the risk of re-traumatisation to the person. So we are working through that so that we can kind of make clear in what circumstances we might ask for what types of evidence. I think also there's an element where we appreciate that everyone's journey is different. So talking to your client around what actually has been their experience and thinking around what contemporaneous documentation they may have that would allow them to establish that when that's needed. We know for certain cohorts in the community that they don't see police stations and hospitals as safe places for historic treatment reasons or historic mistreatment reasons. And so, you know, they're not going to, some cohorts just aren't going to ever go to the police. They aren't going to probably go to the hospital, even if they've got a mental health condition, they'll go somewhere else. So understanding some of those things and working with the taxpayer or your client to kind of work through what you might have. I think also there's an element around, I think, letting your clients know it's okay to disclose the information to the ATO. You know, we know, to be honest, like, spoken to the banks about that, they have the same issue. People perceive us as big and scary and think if they tell the ATO, they're not going to be able to pay their debt for 6 months because of something they're experiencing, that automatically they're going to have the house taken away. So I think trying to reassure your clients that actually providing that information to the ATO might allow us different discretions. But I think maybe some things that we do consider around evidence and what kind of evidence we'll ask for in a dispute setting is we will be looking for evidence that anything that that can talk to or demonstrate the severity and impact that experience has had on the person, contemporaneous evidence, understanding if the taxpayer has financially benefited from that situation or not, whether there's been prior disclosures to the ATO as well. So I think just engaging with this early, transparently, and then kind of is a better approach and a more constructive approach for everyone than I think leaving it to the last minute when our ability and our discretions are less.
So from your perspective, Ruth, what does good practice look like when vulnerability is appropriately raised with the tax office, and do you see the any shortfallings in it at the moment, or I know you did your review into it. I know the Tax Office has accepted most of your recommendations, so it's good that everybody's sort of working off the same page.
All of them in it.
You're accepting all of them on everything these days. Everyone must be doing a very good job.
So I think, what does good practice look like? And again, there's a sort of books written on this about kind of trauma-informed practice and how to support people who are experiencing vulnerability. And I think it goes both to the what and the how. So if you talk about the how first, the word that comes up a lot in my conversations is empathy. And I know there are a lot of really good empathetic people in the ATO. They're all doing busy, hard jobs. And I think just occasionally people come across an example where they haven't received the empathetic response that they were hoping for, either as an individual taxpayer or their representative. So that kind of just starting with kindness is probably the first thing that we should all think of, not just the ATO, but all of us in terms of supporting people experiencing vulnerability. The second thing in my recommendations, going specifically to financial abuse, was how do you actually identify these cases? And for all of us, it can be very, very hard, because for all the things Rob said about these people don't necessarily come with that as a sort of label. They don't come feeling comfortable disclosing their circumstances. Sometimes they deliberately try to hide the circumstances for good reason sometimes. Sometimes their behaviours that are kind of trauma created, like disengaging, like withdrawing, not having the capacity to respond to letters and phone calls, can sometimes be misunderstood as non-compliance, when actually what they're doing is protecting themselves. You know, the human brain under trauma has to protect itself first, and as Anna said right at the beginning, phoning the ATO probably isn't top of the list of things that you have the capacity to do. I recall the case that Annette and I were working on together, where the particular taxpayer that we met together talked in really emotional circumstances about literally not being able to open a letter that she'd received, that she knew was from the tax office, and just being able to hear from her words how traumatising that can be. She didn't even know what the letter was about, she didn't know what the circumstances were, but the capacity that she had to deal with the range of traumas in her life meant that, in terms of going back to the kind of what does good treatment look like, is to give her time, allow her to recover and respond at a time that she can manage, that she has capacity, he or she has capacity to manage, to build that resilience back up and think, actually, I know I have to re-engage with the tax system, but I just can't do that right now. Again, trauma-informed practice likes to give people agency, so not dictating the pace by which you have to do things. That's why that kind of flexibility in treatment and timescales is really important, to allow them to come to the issue when they are ready and able, and also ready and able to be able to tell their story. But as Rob said, the last thing we want to do is re-traumatise people by asking them to repeat themselves over and over again. So one of the conversations I'm having across government, outside of the ATO space, is to make sure that people who are experiencing severe trauma, like people experiencing domestic violence, for example, don't have to repeat their story over and over again. There's so many organisations that you have to disclose to in order to get that flexibility to get into a kind of special support treatment pathway, that you have to tell Centrelink, you have to tell Medicare, you have to tell child support, you have to tell the ATO, you quite often have to tell your utility company, your bank, etc. And as government, at least, we should be able to come to a way of actually defining what we ask for and being able to share that information. So not something I can fix on my own there, but I am having conversations across government in how do we kind of unify a government response there. And then finally, so a lot of that is in the kind of how do we treat people. In the what, again, in my recommendations, is really to recognise these people do need different circumstances. There should be a different pathway once they've been identified. There should be separate teams who've got that truly empathetic approach, have got perhaps a little bit more time to treat people differently, and to have that the regulated discretion that the Commission has delegated to those people so that we can help them reconnect and re-engage with the tax system when they're able to do so, to get back on track. Again, going back to what Anna said at the beginning, most people in these circumstances, their biggest desire is to get out of the debt or the circumstances that they're in. So giving them that opportunity to re-engage when they're ready, to pay back the debt at a time and at a pace that they have the capacity to do so.
Nice. And I just point out there, Ruth, the case that you were discussing, if I would mention, that this lady who was involved was actually a very high-functioning lawyer in a very big AXS-listed company who was so used to dealing with a lot of this in her life, but had an event that occurred and took her to a point that she didn't want to open her mail. So it's not like it affects everybody in every day, the walk of life, the people that are affected by it. It's just not how we sometimes imagine those people to be. This person was a very highly functioning person in a job, had an event that occurred in her life that then got her to a position that she got into a bit of trouble with the AT. It was non-lodgements of tax returns and things like that. So it's not always the debt either. It's the non-lodgement of returns, BASs, things like that. And of course, it will come to a debt situation at some point. And we mentioned also with vulnerability in the beginning that it's not always a long-term one, so it can be short-term. So you can have clients that might have health issues or be going through family issues, or mental health issues, and it can be a short-term basis, but within that 6 months to a year, they might actually need additional assistance or help, just to pause the noise for a little while till they get back on their feet and things like that. So just don't think of it as the big end as well. There is other issues in the vulnerability framework that the tax office have acknowledged is a form of vulnerability, okay? So, Rob, when vulnerability does affect a client's ability to engage, such as they've missed some deadlines, they've, dealing with some emotional distress or their difficulty understanding decisions that have been made, what flexibility exists within the current system now for you? And I think Anna also spoke about that as well, some of the support mechanisms. But also, are there any changes on the horizon due to the new framework and some of the additional work that you might be doing?
So a bit in that question. I think, we do already in some circumstances try to provide that support proactively. So like thinking about natural disasters, I think we'll try and pause people's obligations where it's short term and try and give them some time to get back on track. I think what's coming is, in terms of in this space, is about us making sure, as I kind of talked about a little bit before, about being clear around what we can and cannot do, around some of our discretions, and being clearer around the types of information we may ask for, and also being clearer about and making updates to practice statements and website guidance and things like that, so we can kind of make clear what we can and cannot do. Associated with that, though, we are doing training. So we're training our staff. There's a bit where if someone's experiencing a vulnerability, experiencing something in their life, and our frontline staff might be able to still treat them, like deal with them in an empathetic manner, deal with it. They don't need to go through a specialised support team. So we are looking at, working through in what circumstances, we the frontline person doesn't need that person, that taxpayer doesn't need to be escalated to a specialised team. So we're working through that. And Anna talked about our tailored support hub, which is one of those examples about having a process where we identify that person might have additional needs, they need specialised support. So that's something we're looking at internally, not just in frontline, but we're thinking about in the context across the office, because a taxpayer doesn't just, engages across a range of elements of the pillars of tax administration. So there's some of that coming, which we're hoping will assist in some clarity around what we can and cannot do and how people can get help. But, it is a journey for us. I think we acknowledge that. Like, this is going to take us time to implement the principles of the framework. We're a big organisation. And I think there's that acknowledgement that, you know, for us to get it right, it is going to continue to involve engagement and feedback and discussion with the tax practitioners, given your important role in the system, but also other partners in the system as well. So I think that's some work you'll see over the next few months. And we're also looking at things based on Bruce's recommendations about how we can make sure that when people do disclose circumstances to us, that we can make sure that information is available next time they call or next time they contact with us, so they don't have to repeat their story within the ATO, because we've heard that. However, we are trying to balance that with agency. So we have heard, as we've talked about before, giving people agency. So we are looking at how we do that in a way where that person, you know, if they've disclosed that they're in a domestic violence situation to someone in a specialised support hub or as part of an ejection, that automatically doesn't mean that that information is available to every staff member every time they call up. So that's a more complex system thing for us to do, but, you know, we are looking at a range of things that will be both public-facing and provide transparency, but also internally around our processes, support and people to really support people experiencing vulnerability and ensure, I think, a more consistent approach.
No, thank you. Now to you, Ruth. So what patterns are you seeing in complaints where vulnerability have contributed to any tax disputes or tax concerns escalating unnecessarily to your office?
I think, the context here is quite important, isn't it? I guess we're in that kind of post-COVID cost of living pressures, cost of doing business pressures, small businesses doing tough. We're in that kind of moment, and now we're in a war in the Middle East as well. You know, there's all sorts of pressures on people, but perhaps we're just seeing a little bit of that perfect storm where, and again, I support the ATO in their collection strategy. The nation needs ATO to bring the money in, but it does mean we've seen a very strong swing in the posture of the ATO over the last few years in terms of collection, and Anna made it really clear very clearly this morning what the ATO is doing to make sure that it brings the money in on behalf of the nation. So you've just got these kind of colliding forces, if you like, of the ATO needing to do that, deliberately taking a different tack to the way they manage and collect debt, as Anna said, much more quickly, while people in the community and small businesses probably had got used to a different way of working with the ATO, and now we've got that crunch of cash flow issues, family budget issues, small businesses struggling and needing time to pay, and of course Payday Super as well will create additional cash flow issues. So I guess that's the sort of the whole picture I'm seeing in the complaints that I deal with, that it's not just one thing, it's a kind of a range of forces just bringing together the fact that the debt collection is the vast majority of the complaints that I receive in my office. You probably won't be surprised to know that. I hope you're not surprised to know that most people who do complain to my office desperately want to pay their tax back. These aren't people who are saying, is there any way I can not pay? These are people saying, please help me pay. Please help me find a way that the ATO will accept my offer of repayment. And that goes to that kind of flexibility. We are definitely seeing those sort of mental health issues, and I think just the financial stresses in the community right now is probably exacerbating a range of mental health pressures. And as I said, not just for people experiencing vulnerability, but for all of us, we're one life event away from being in a very difficult place. And, you know, you just need a bereavement, or you just need a supply chain failure, or you just need a divorce or something to happen in your life for everything else to disappear really quickly. So that's the sort of picture I'm seeing. It's the complexity of people's lives, people's businesses, at a time when the nation has asked the ATO to reduce that debt book to get the money in to spend on other important national resources. So no easy answer to that other than everything we've talked about today is that's the right thing for the ATO to do, but let's just be kind and let's just recognise some people do need different treatment, and let's not let anybody fall between the cracks.
No worries. And so what would, you know, a taxpayer or a professional need to do first before making a referral or a complaint to your organisation?
Just a reminder, thank you, Annette. So anybody can raise a complaint with my office, either about the ATO or the Tax Practitioners Board. But the one caveat to that being, I am, as an ombudsman, an escalation service. So you must give the ATO or the TPB the right to try and resolve that complaint at first instance. Of course, that's absolutely right. The quicker that they can resolve the complaint, the better for all involved. But if you fail to get resolution from your formal complaint to the ATO, and I say formal deliberately because I get quite a lot of complaints from people saying, yeah, I've complained to the ATO 10 times. And then I say, well, can you show me your complaint reference number? Well, no, I just rang 10 times and those turned into complaints. So please, if you're going to raise a complaint with the ATO, get it registered. If you don't get resolution, and I hope you do, but if you don't get resolution, then you can escalate it to my office.
No worries. Thank you for that. And I think we've spoken about this as we've gone through some of the other points today. And I think you've mentioned it, Rob and Ruth, about, you know, at what point in the dispute cycle can early recognition of vulnerability prevent escalation of the tax office's tools? That we might see them issuing notices and things like that. And can also, another question I'll put in there as well, is if you're engaged some sort of in a dispute recognition with the ATO over whether it's non-lodgements, default assessments, payments, can vulnerability come in at any stage? So if we were going along okay, we were in dispute with you, and then all of a sudden something's happened in our life, can we raise it at that point and say, look, this has happened, can we call vulnerability out at this point? What do you think about that?
So I think we've talked about, you know, it's better to disclose it as early as you can. Yeah. I think where it occurs as, you know, in where someone's then experienced something partway through an engagement with the ACO, making the ATO know that is important, and you know that will be considered in terms of how we respond. Mm. I think in some of those situations, though, we do need to think about the integrity of the system.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And so, you know, unfortunately, we do see some people that try and use or hold out that they're experiencing something when they're not, to try and obfuscate their tax obligations or their responsibilities, and so that's really a hard area for the ATO. I think that's why if you're disclosing it early and there's a pattern of it being disclosed to the ATO and we're aware of that early, it allows us to better differentiate between where people legitimately need support and where perhaps for the small amount of cases people are trying to game the system. So I think that's why the importance of just being open and transparent early is really important, noting, you know, that person may have a life event midway through the engagement that means their circumstances change, but just being transparent with us is best.
No worries. Yes. And so if I could ask both of you as a final question before we go to taking some questions, is what is one piece of advice you would give our audience today to assist them in dealing with vulnerable taxpayers that they might have in their practice?
I think we've covered a lot today, but I think be open-minded. I think hopefully one of your takeaways from today is vulnerability comes in all shapes and sizes and is sometimes very hard to see straight away. So just be open-minded to any of your clients experiencing vulnerability. And again, just a reminder, you know, particularly in those financial abuse cases, it might be the clients that you're not seeing that you think you need to consider most. But yeah. As with the ATO, as with ourselves, treat everybody with empathy and be open to the fact that they may have a hidden vulnerability that you're not aware of.
I probably had some similar thoughts to Ruth, but maybe another point as well, like we're not expecting you to be social workers. Mm-hmm. Like I think it's important that you remember, like a bit like the ATO recognises our role, we don't expect tax professionals to be social workers or to be the psychologist that has to make an assessment around whether someone's experiencing vulnerability. You know, I think, but you can play an important role in working with your client to help explain that to the ATO, and so we know early. And I think I've had one or two cases recently where the tax professional themselves has felt like they've needed to take a broader advocacy kind of social work element for their client, and that's really commendable of them, but it's actually impacted their own mental health. And so, you know, just being conscious of, you know, at least from the ATO perspective, we don't have any expectation that tax professionals are social workers or experts in vulnerability. I think it's just, like everyone, it's about being aware of the signs and thinking about what's the appropriate support pathways. And I know a number of the tax profession, I know a number of the associations and institutes recently have been or in the process of you know, providing additional guidance or training to their members about that. So that's always something that's worth just kind of making sure you've turned your attention to.
No, thank you. Okay, so I have a couple of questions that have come through. So one of them is, mainly probably to you, Rob, is what level of evidence... What protections exist to ensure that vulnerability disclosures, if somebody comes and we've either, you know, so themselves, their agent, and says this is the vulnerability that we're thing, are handled appropriately and with confidentiality from the tax office point of view?
So, you know, I think we have quite strong privacy protocols anyway, but an acknowledgement, I think, and we call this out in the framework, that people that have experienced vulnerability and trauma, this becomes more of a concern for them or a priority for them, especially where they think that may create other risks, you know, around violence or et cetera. So, you know, we are cognizant of this, and this is kind of the point I was talking about before, about like us thinking about how we have a systems approach that allows a tell-me-once principle but still allows the agency for the person, so about who may that information may be shared with, so that we can try and give that person some agency over their information, their story, so they don't be re-traumatised. So it's something we are cognizant of. We think we have pretty good controls now around privacy, but we know for people experiencing vulnerability, specifically certain types like, you know, domestic violence, financial abuse, that there may be additional differences in terms of how we engage with that client and how we record and treat that information in our systems.
Yeah, that's great. And a question, I'll pose this to you, Ruth. You know, are there any recommended, as Rob's pointed out, we're not counsellors ourselves, we're, you know, tax agents, accountants, lawyers, helping people in that tax space, so we're not recognised counsellors or financial counsellors. But if we did have a client come to us and we recognised something, what sort of referral points or support services practitioners should be aware of if they've identified it? Should we, you know, is there places that we could assist and reach out and give the client advice of where they could go to?
Yeah, great question. That builds nicely on what Rob said. It's like it takes a village to help everybody, and we should all play our respective role. So knowing where your limits are and where to hand over to somebody who's got either clinical or more other professional expertise is a really important thing to do, and the professional bodies have definitely done some great work on their website or suggestions of places where you can refer them. The answer obviously depends on the type of vulnerability that you may be seeing in or having disclosed to you from your clients, but that, you know, there are a range of people out there in the community that are there specifically to help people in vulnerable circumstances. That could be a financial counsellor, it could be DV experts, it could be social workers, it could be community legal centres, housing associations, etc. So depending on what the area is of vulnerability, even just going to see their GP might be a good place to start. So just have a think about your own area and where those places are, and familiarise yourself with those kind of agencies, and be ready to know where to refer your clients to should that need arise.
Thank you. Does anybody have a question from the floor at all they'd like to pose before we round up this session? No? Okay. Well, I'd like to now invite Amy Toaster from Accounting Insurance to come up and say a few words, and thank you to Accounting Insurance for being one of our sponsors at this event.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Amy Toaster, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Tori Flowers. We are genuinely thrilled to be attending the WA Tax Forum again. Events like this bring together a strong professional community, and we are proud to be a part of it. Many of you in this room have worked with us for years. Your trust and ongoing partnership means a great deal to us. Strong relationships are central to our business, not just commercially, but professionally as well. Audit Shield has been a proven and reliable solution for over two decades, trusted by thousands of firms. At its core, our model is designed to support you. We are proud to offer one of the only genuine no net cost, no loss solutions when it comes to comprehensive tax audit insurance. When the ATO increase our activity, as we have seen over time, our role is to help turn what can be a stressful audit process into a manageable, seamless outcome for both of you and your clients. On behalf of the team, we'd like to thank you for welcoming us to this event today. Thank you.